This is the Takeaway Podcast for Thursday, May 26, 2016.
This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. It was the beginning of what was to be an invasion of Japan, the arrival in and conquest of the island of Okinawa way back in 1945, towards the end of World War II.
In American hands, Okinawa would mean the reduction of Japan from a powerful empire to an isolated land awaiting the shock of invasion.
The war ended, but the U.S. invasion never did, and now a U.S. president has landed in Japan.
As Prime Minister Abe indicated, we did discuss the tragedy that took place in Okinawa, and I extended my sincerest condolences and deepest regrets. And the United States will continue to cooperate fully with the investigation to ensure that justice is done under the Japanese legal system.
President Obama is not speaking of an incident from long ago. The president faced local protests and outrage over the rape and murder of a 20-year-old Japanese woman, allegedly by a U.S. military-based contractor in Okinawa, part of a pattern of crimes against the women of Okinawa that has raised tensions in U.S.-Japan relations for years. It's just one of the complications as the U.S. pushes to relocate a Marine base to the mainland of Japan. The latest incident has further heightened decades-long discontent with U.S. military facilities, particularly on the island of Okinawa. Okinawa is a hardship assignment for the U.S. military, but even that is putting it mildly. During the Vietnam era, Okinawa was a staging area for all kinds of weapons, including the toxic herbicide Agent Orange.
There was a habu on this side and a habu on this side where the barrels were, about 100, 120 feet or something like that away from us. And we always wondered what the heck were those 55-gallon barrels with the orange ring around them.
It was mixed 50-50. I was instructed how to do it. I was told that it was Agent Orange. It was a herbicide. It would also help to keep the mosquitoes down.
U.S. veterans Ron Frazier and Joe Cipolla, who were featured in the documentary Defoliated Island, Agent Orange, Okinawa and the Vietnam War. It's based on reporting and research by John Mitchell, a British journalist based in Japan, who's author of the book Chasing Agent Orange on Okinawa. I spoke with Mitchell from Tokyo, where he says the wretched stewardship of Okinawa by the United States complicates all kinds of issues between the two nations, from efforts to get Japan to curtail its whaling fleet to changing its currency policies.
Ever since the end of World War II, which was 1945, the American military, they've been poisoning Okinawa's environment. Within a few years of the end of the war, over 24 Okinawans were poisoned during an arsenic poisoning incident on one of the outlying islands. And ever since then, the military has been poisoning the land, the sea, and the air of Okinawa.
And is that because just of the functioning of the base, or is there something particular that's going on at Okinawa that is injurious to the environment?
More than anywhere else in Japan, probably, Okinawa has suffered from American weapons of mass destruction, especially during the Cold War, where we had the war in Korea and the war in Vietnam. The American military, they stockpiled chemical weapons in Okinawa. They put biological weapons there. They put nuclear weapons, and they stored Agent Orange. And since that time, there have been a number of accidents involving these chemicals. During the late 1960s and early 1970s, there were two leaks of nerve gas on Okinawa, which actually hospitalized more than 24 Americans. And then Agent Orange, of course, has been the main killer of people, both Americans and Okinawans in the island.
How would you compare the behavior and the environmental stewardship at Okinawa to similar kinds of concerns in other facilities around the world that the U.S. manages?
There's a lack of transparency when it comes to the American bases on Okinawa. In the United States, there's over 140 areas that have been listed by the EPA in need of dire cleaning. But overseas, the American military isn't responsible for checking the bases or for cleaning them up. So because of the Okinawan situation, where it's in a limbo, really, the American military doesn't need to come clean about contamination within its bases. So that means there's only a few ways open to people to find out how contaminated they are. First of all, you can interview whistleblowers from the military. You can use Freedom of Information Act, or you can test the land that's been returned by military bases. And all of those three methods, we found out that there's horrific contamination on Okinawa.
What's the cost, the potential challenge if the United States were to aggressively clean this mess up on Okinawa and then just leave altogether?
Due to the variety of contaminants, we've got lead, asbestos, dioxin, we've got heavy metals, we've got pesticides. It's going to cost millions upon millions of dollars to clean up these bases. They're looking to return Futenma Air Station within the next few years. And if Futenma's ever returned to Okinawan civilian control, then it'll probably be billions of yen. And also it's probably going to take decades before it's cleaned up. And all of this contamination, it goes back to mainly the war in Vietnam. So during the Vietnam War, Okinawa served as the military's main launch pad for fighting in Vietnam. There was a famous quote by an American general, and he said that without Okinawa, we couldn't continue fighting the war in Vietnam. So everything for the military war machine, it was stored on Okinawan bases. Everything from toilet paper to beer to guard dogs. And also Agent Orange was stored there as well. And because Agent Orange was stored on Okinawa and also it was buried on Okinawa when it was surplus or when it was damaged, the potential costs and also the human health issue, it's unfathomable. Nobody can work it out yet.
And how would you say the environmental profile and this contamination issue has fared given the very, very difficult sort of human rights questions on Okinawa, where Okinawa personnel have actually interacted with the Japanese citizens, and there have been rape cases, and all of that is a very much a complicating factor between the U.S. and the Japanese.
It's a really good question. I think, first of all, the contamination issue, it shows that contamination, it doesn't know any fences. People within the bases and people outside the bases, they've been poisoned by these toxins. We've got American schools within Kadena Air Base that are located next to a dioxin dump site. And from my interviews, we've got over a dozen parents who say their children are sick from dioxin contamination. So to be honest, this issue, it unites both Americans and also Okinawans, because both of them have been equally affected by this. And I think it really shines a light on the Pentagon's hypocrisy as well, whereby the Okinawans, they see that the American military is not cleaning up this contamination. And also the American service members, they see that their own superior officers are denying this contamination as well. So actually it's become a way for both sides to kind of unite together in kind of an ironic and strange way. We've got over 250 American veterans who believe they're poisoned by Agent Orange and Okinawa. We've got Okinawan base workers who believe they were exposed, and also base workers who possibly died from dioxin exposure as well. And then we've got the civilian impact of dioxin poisoning on the island. In the late 1960s, there were 230 school children who suffered burns when they were swimming near a beach that had just been sprayed with Agent Orange on the east coast of Okinawa. So this is a problem that has affected people across generations. It's affected people on both sides of the wire. And the American military, they're denying all of this, just like they deny the effect of Agent Orange in Vietnam.
Is there any expectation that the president will address this? Will he be forced to address it by Japanese citizens?
Obama's going to go to Hiroshima, and he probably will not even visit Okinawa. The Japanese government would actually oppose his visit to Okinawa, because Okinawa has been oppressed by both sides. It's been oppressed by the American government and the Japanese government. It's always been something that they have been, it's always been an island, and they're prepared to sacrifice for the what they see as the greater good. So the chance of Obama visiting Okinawa is very, very unlikely.
John Mitchell is a journalist and author of the book Chasing Agent Orange on Okinawa. Thank you so much, John.
Thanks, John.
On his Japanese trip, President Obama expressed regret for the alleged murder of a Japanese woman on Okinawa by a U.S. serviceman. Have you ever had to apologize for the actions of someone else whose behavior reflected on you in some way? What's the most difficult apology you ever had to make? Were there ever times you wish you had said sorry but didn't?
This is Liz from Austin, Texas. I'm still in the middle of an apology. I think about it every day. Even though I know the other person has forgiven me, I still feel the need to say I'm sorry all the time.
This is Bridget Shea, and I'm calling from Austin, Texas. A really difficult apology that I made was with someone I'd had a very public disagreement with. Our apology and making up ended up on the front page of the newspaper. And I think it was a powerful lesson for people in forgiveness.
This is Michelle calling from Honolulu. Well, I once had an office manager who was meaner than Scrooge on a bad day. While on vacation from that job, I was offered a position at another company, and I took it, and just never went back to the first job to properly quit. I eventually had to own my part and make amends to that person, as well as to the company's owner who had hired me in the first place. It was humiliating, but it was worth it to have a clean slate.
Listen to these lessons in redemption. A lot of stories there from Austin, Texas. And I love that story from you, Michelle, in Honolulu from New York. I was at a wild party in college with my friend Mike, and I saw a guy from my history class and said some terrible things about him, weird, ugly, etc. That's when Mike told me it was his brother. I never quite recovered from that, and I don't think Mike ever really accepted my apology.
This is Leela, calling from Oakland. And on a visit home some years ago, I outed a gay man that I had just met at a gathering my parents were hosting. When I learned he was an assistant principal at a local Dallas high school, I asked him how he was dealing with backwards attitude from Texans. And it turns out that the way he was dealing with it was by being very private. I ended up writing him an email of apology, which was really hard. And he graciously accepted it.
Oh, man, that hurts in the stomach to hear that story. North Providence, Rhode Island, my most difficult apology was when I had to sit down with my two daughters, who were 16 and 12 at the time, and tell them I was divorcing their mother and that everything was going to be all right when I really did not know it was going to be all right at all. Steamboat Springs, Colorado. In my late 20s, I apologized to my mom for being such an annoyance in high school in my early 20s. I was so tough because it was so honest and it was such a burden I'd carried around. I know I was doing the best I could at the time, and I didn't want to bring it up again in my late 20s, but I wanted to make sure she knows how much I appreciate her and love her. I think it was so tough because I didn't want her to blame herself for any of my behavior.
My name is Jay Walker. I'm calling from DeKalb, Illinois. So my parents had left on vacation and left my aunt in charge of me, and for the 3 weeks they were gone, I was just disrespectful and rude and eventually had to go stay with someone else. As time had passed, I'd come back to a family party, and there I'd seen that same aunt that was there to take care of me, Aunt Esther. So I went up and apologized to her. She had let me off the hook. She told me how hard it was on her, but how much she appreciated that apology. And from that moment on, her and I were just really close friends up until the day she died.
Tacoma, Washington. The most difficult apology I ever had to make occurred when I realized I'd wanted to be right. We were driving home to our farm from Council Bluffs, Iowa, about a 220-mile drive. My husband took a shortcut onto a graveled road where he occasionally turned the wrong direction. I immediately told him he'd turned the wrong way. We kept going, and I soon realized my error, and then I knew I'd wanted to be right. My husband and our two sons, probably around 11 and 9, all got the best laugh at my apology. Yeah, you can be right. The rightest thing you can do is call 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people build their CQ or Curious quotient through the game of lifelong learning. Curious, where people can learn something new every day at Curious.com/PRI.
As we report on environmental disasters caused by the U.S. military in Okinawa, we should note that the track record of the U.S. in causing industrial ground contamination is no better at home. Love Canal was a working-class planned suburb of Niagara Falls, New York, until it became known as America's toxic zip code, 14304. In the 40s and 50s, the Hooker Chemical Company dumped more than 20,000 tons of toxic waste into the ground at the site, which continued to be developed upon well into the 70s. Residents had complained about health problems for years, but the protest movement, led by women like Lois Gibbs, reached a fever pitch in 1978. Activism eventually led to a national conversation about toxic waste sites and the passage of the EPA Superfund legislation. Historian Richard Newman wrote a book about the disaster called Love Canal, A Toxic History from Colonial Times to the Present. Richard, welcome to The Takeaway.
It's great to be with you.
When was it first discovered that Love Canal might be a toxic waste zone?
Well, the story here is very much like what you see in Flint, where what we now know of as the environmental disaster was actually part of a narrative of community discord and unrest for a couple of years. So Love Canal is built up as a residential zone in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, and young working middle-class families are actually pretty happy, but there's always this undercurrent of environmental unrest because weird things happen in Love Canal. Manhole covers will explode spontaneously. Families and children get chemical burns playing on the grass outside of baseball diamonds, and they complain to politicians and administrators and health officials. And so throughout the 70s, you see this steady current of complaints. But after studying the problems, officials usually say, we have the matter contained, we're going to make some improvements. And only in the late 1970s, when these residential complaints reach a fever pitch, do state health officials do a massive study. And in August of 1978, they release the results saying that there's a health peril in Niagara Falls. They've discovered that there are roughly 200 toxic chemicals buried beneath the landscape. There are elevated levels of miscarriage, birth defects, elevated levels of suicide and depression in the neighborhood. And so the response of health officials is to not only say that there's a real problem in the area, but to evacuate a small minority of families. But of course, this creates more consternation and even hysteria because the rest of the residents living in the 10-block area say, well, what about us?
When did the federal government assert its authority in the Love Canal case and in others like it?
EPA officials had been aware of some of the leaking dump site problems in the mid to late 70s, but they were always worried about setting a precedent. Only after 1978 and the big blow-up that features residents becoming media darlings and organizing a whole series of protest movements does the federal government get really interested in Love Canal. But still then, it takes a couple of years of activism to get the whole neighborhood evacuated. So President Carter issues the first emergency declaration in early August of 1978, and that provides for the evacuation of about 25% of the neighborhood. A second emergency declaration by the president in May of 1980 results in the temporary and then the full and complete evacuation of the remaining 75% of the homeowners and the renters. And then Superfund is passed in December of 1980. But it's really interesting to think about what the federal government would have done if there wasn't an activist movement pushing all along. And so people like Lois Gibbs and this group of unheralded women are really responsible for forcing congressmen, presidential officials, health officials to really come to terms with the Love Canal disaster.
Have you seen the chain link, the famous chain link around the Superfund site?
Well, that's why I first got interested in the book. It was really fantastical. There's this massive chain link fence around what looks like a school playground. The grass is cut in the summer. There are shrubs and trees. Birds land and chirp. It's actually fairly pretty. There's no signage on the fence itself that says, this is Love Canal, site of America's worst man-made environmental disaster. And over the last 30 years, I discovered that there was an amazing debate about resettling the landscape. Niagara Falls is a deindustrializing city. Folks wanted to get some of those tax rolls bolstered, and so they ended up refurbishing and resettling about 250 homes north of the dump. And so if you go back today, what you will see is on one side of the neighborhood, the chain link fence around the dump, and on the other side of the neighborhood, homes that are inhabited.
It's not an accident, I suppose, that this disaster took place on one side of this huge freshwater watershed in North America called the Great Lakes. Facing the Love Canal zone geographically is Flint, Michigan, over on the other side of Lake Huron. Is this a story of what industrial capitalism did to this pristine freshwater ecosystem?
The thing that I think takes us beyond industrial capitalism is culture. At Love Canal in Flint, Michigan, what you see is the idea that certain communities are written out of politics, of civic discourse. In places around Niagara Falls where you see these dumping grounds, you see lower middle class and lower income populations. You see African Americans in Flint, Michigan, in the inner city where you see this horrible lead crisis. There's a whole century-long history associated with industrial capitalism of political neglect that has taken these people out of the political equation. And so again, when I talk to people now, I say, we shouldn't just focus on the environmental disaster at Love Canal. We should focus in on the remedy, which was the incredible protest movement that these unheralded and politically insignificant people created. And in the same way, you can see that going on in Flint, Michigan. This isn't just about one city. This is about the problem of environmental neglect in all cities. And so soon after the issue popped up in Flint, Michigan, you saw people in Newark, in Philadelphia, across the country talking about the problem of lead poisoning in their communities. That's exactly what happened in Love Canal. As soon as the issue appeared in the summer of 1978, people around the country started investigating hazardous waste sites in their own backyard. That was the impetus for a national law like Superfund. And so hopefully that's what's going to happen at Flint, Michigan, is this will not be viewed as a one-off problem, but as a symbol for a whole series of problems.
Richard Newman is a historian and author of Love Canal, A Toxic History from Colonial Times to the Present. Thanks so much, Richard.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. A new leadership in Brazil will represent a gigantic milestone for the largest nation in South America. We'll dig into the question of where Brazil is headed a little later this hour. But first, the leadership shakeup in the Taliban after the assassination of Mullah Mansour by an American drone strike. Haybatullah Ahunzada is a well-known Taliban religious leader. He's the replacement, and he's part of the Deputy Leadership Council, known for his religious scholarship. Richard Barrett is Senior Vice President at the Sufan Group, a security consultancy, and former coordinator of the UN team monitoring al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Richard, is the new leader Haybatullah Ahunzada an ideologue, or does he seek to direct more tactical operations against the Afghan government?
He's more of an ideologue. In fact, his career has really been mostly in the Justice Department, if you want to call it that, of the Taliban. Quite a fierce judge, you know, one who imposed quite serious penalties on people who didn't agree with the leadership. Close to Mullah Omar, the first leader of the Taliban. Some reports say he was a religious advisor to Mullah Omar. And clearly that's been his background in religion, in Sharia courts, and so on, rather than on the battlefield.
Does it suggest that the Taliban wants to morph into more of a religious organization, supplying social services through its schools and other institutions?
Well, that's certainly one source of its strength and support. But I think they learned from the previous leader, Mullah Akhtar Mansour, the difficulties that he had in establishing himself as leader, was largely, or in some part at least, because he lacked religious authority. And I think they reckoned that to have somebody who clearly does have some religious authority would be more of a unifying step than, for example, appointing the other deputy to Mullah Akhtar Mansour, who is Sirajuddin Haqqani.
So what is the division? It's apparently not religious. So what would be the division in the mission or the understanding, the conception of the Taliban at this point in time?
Well, I think that the divisions are self-serving in that being leader of the Taliban gives you access to a great deal of money and patronage, of course, because the drug trade is such a huge amount of Taliban income now. So there's that point. But also, I guess, there's the sense of where's the Taliban going? Is it going to negotiate peace with the Afghan government, or is it going to hold out for the fall of the Afghan government and an opportunity to retake control? I think a third, a new factor, perhaps, is the possibly growing presence of the Islamic State and other rival groups in Afghanistan, which make the Taliban more concerned, perhaps, to have a very solid religious base rather than sort of be seen as just one more armed faction.
And ISIS does not have to rely on drug money to fund its operations. So how does the leadership of the Taliban reconcile the use of drugs as a funding mechanism, as a commodity, essentially, and its religious purity?
Yes, well, this has been a problem for them in the past. And of course, at one stage, when the Taliban were sort of in charge in Afghanistan or over large parts of it, they said drugs were bad and attempted to ban them. And I think still they would argue that good Muslims don't take drugs. But insofar as these drugs are all ending up in the bodies of Westerners, then it's okay. You know, it doesn't really matter. And I think that's how they justify it.
Does the Taliban want to hold territory? And does ISIS have an advantage militarily in attempting to take territory in Afghanistan?
Well, the ISIS guys are over in the east of Afghanistan, and most of the Taliban-controlled areas are in the south and southeast. And so they don't overlap too much. But I'm absolutely sure that ISIS guys will try to extend their control of territory into areas which are currently held by Taliban. And if I'm to believe the Afghan authorities, then there are young Taliban who are moving over to join ISIS, and therefore that will undermine perhaps the Taliban control in some areas.
Richard Barrett is senior vice president at the Sufan Group, a security consultancy. He's former coordinator of the UN team that monitors al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Richard Barrett, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Por favor.
An update now on the huge leadership crisis in the nation of Brazil. Those are members of suspended Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff's government chanting Dilma, fighter of the Brazilian nation. Nevertheless, impeachment proceedings against Rousseff continue. But those in Brazil calling the proceedings a coup and a cover-up were shouting, I told you so this week briefly, after tapes of Planning Minister Romero Juca surfaced of him saying that he was colluding with the military to take Rousseff out of office. But those allegations quickly joined the river of corruption and judicial proceedings that have brought this country to a virtual standstill. The nation is only in its third decade of uninterrupted democracy after 20 years of military rule ended in 1985. We go now to Lucia Guimarães, a columnist and correspondent for O Estado de São Paulo, a Brazilian daily newspaper.
Thank you, John.
Explain how this entire crisis is an assessment of democracy in Brazil on some level.
It is indeed a test of democracy, but it is not a coup d'etat, as it's been frequently described. It was a constitutional process, a very ugly one, because we have Congress, the lower house and the Senate, have about 60% of their elected members have some problem with prosecution, corruption. So it's an ugly process. It's a test, but I don't think Brazilian democracy has been weakened by this.
Is the mechanism there to clean it up in Brazil and to people believe that this process eventually will lead to a passing of the torch to a fundamentally different, more honest or civically responsible leadership class?
Not anytime soon, and I don't think people believe that because of the power of money in elections in Brazil. You would have to change laws for that. And because of the number of parties, there are something like 28 parties in Congress right now.
Does Rousseff represent a particular approach to running the country that is her own, or is she really very much in a venerable tradition?
She's very much alone now. She's very stubborn. She's not a competent manager by any means. The other thing that people don't realize is that Lula, who's still the leader of the party, the probably still the most popular politician in Brazil, he would like to see her disappear into the sunset because he really blames her for destroying his legacy, what he thinks it's his legacy.
Not only his legacy, but the potential for the Workers' Party, which is an important voice in the economy in Brazil, to function in power. What is the next step? Is there a successor party or a successor candidate?
No. What happens is the Workers' Party still has its base, but it has disappointed people a great deal. There's a plea bargain coming up that is terrifying Dilma that could impeach her ticket, which would mean the interim president for being her vice president would be impeached too. Mm. The Workers' Party is really in a crisis. It will lose probably a lot of mayoral elections in October, but it's still a popular party. But Dilma was very unpopular, and people wanted to see her gone.
The economy in Brazil, when it was running as the envy of the hemisphere, if not the world, Petrobras's behavior was seen as part of that Brazilian genius. Now, there's no way really to get that back. Is there a policy that can turn things around in Brazil?
No. The problems are very serious. They're structural problems. What happens is the Workers' Party, Lula, started this. He squandered the opportunity when things were good to make some reforms. So he came up with Dilma. He needed to prop her up. And then he started spending a lot of money, completely distanced himself from reforms. And then she came in and was very fiscally irresponsible. So this is long-term reform that Brazil needs, and there's very little time for the interim president, who's not a popular man, who needs to approve reforms in Congress, and we have a very corrupt Congress.
The thing that's mystifying to me about Brazil, and this is maybe more of a cultural question, I mean, there's so much corruption. There's such a difficulty in the economy. So much money has changed hands. I mean, somebody must be doing well here. Somebody must be the winner here.
Including the Workers' Party, you know, themselves. I mean, the elite of the Workers' Party, they have money abroad. I mean, there's so much graft and corruption. The political system breeds this type of corruption. And also there's something that is staggering that people don't know is that 22,000 people in Brazil, because they are elected for office or they occupy a ministry, they have what we call foro privilegiado, which is if they're prosecuted, they don't go to a regular judge. They go straight to the Supreme Court. So they have a special track to justice.
And this will all be going on in the middle of the Olympics. Is Brazil ready and Rio ready for the Olympics? And what will the world see when the Olympics comes to town?
Things are delayed. I heard that at least one subway line will be open just 4 days before the Olympics. But here's the thing. To do an Olympic game, you stage it. But the population... You know, once everybody's gone, they're going to be in the same bad shape that they are now. So it's not so hard to prop up something and make the Olympics work.
So it'll look very glittery during the Olympics, but those rings are going to look like handcuffs once the games are over.
Yeah, and the city is very violent. And already the new defense minister and the Rio police, they're going to send in National Guard and military as of July because there's a lot of crime.
Lúcia Guimarães is a columnist and correspondent for O Estado de São Paulo. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
What are you wearing? Who wants to know? The answer increasingly these days is no one. It's liberation, folks. We're all free. That's right. In just a few decades, we've gone from strict codes of dress enforced by narrow social norms or explicit dress codes to no rules aside from good advice here and there about how to deal with piercings and tattoos on the job.
There's always a way to hide your tattoos. I have friends that have sleeves that wear like body armor to work. There's ways around it. Things that in the event that you do need to go to court or get a corporate job, they can be covered with long sleeves and a, you know, high-collared shirt.
Did you write that down? It's a hairstylist on YouTube, a helpful hairstylist on YouTube, whose name is Maybe Sailor, with some good advice for modern living. Today, our social norms are probably more likely to be enforced in TV comedies.
Hey, Meredith, can I talk to you privately for a second?
About what?
Your outfit.
What? What's wrong with my outfit?
You might consider pulling it down a touch. Trying up a little high.
Bunch of prudes. You know, Oscar's allowed to wear sandals, but I'm not allowed to wear open toed shoes. Is that how it goes?
Meredith, your boob is out.
Fine.
The Office, a TV show, not reality. And how has the American workplace been scoured clean of the gothic handcuffs and straitjackets of the old dress codes? Well, Susan Scafidi is founder and academic director of the Fashion Law Institute at Fordham University School of Law. Welcome.
It's nice to be here, John. Thank you for having me.
And I should say, for New Yorkers who understand that Fordham has a campus in the Bronx.
We are actually at Lincoln Center.
Right, 60th. And you are dressed for Midtown, not the Bronx campus, where you might be more of a jeans kind of thing, right, if you were up there.
In fact, the Bronx campus is right across from the Botanical Garden, so yeah, a little more casual.
Exactly, exactly. Did lawyers scour us free of employer-based dress codes that are maybe a little more draconian?
In fact, in New York City, we have taken a giant step forward. As recently as the 1960s, laws against cross-dressing were being enforced, even in New York. Today, the New York City Commission on Human Rights has told us that it is illegal to have a gender-specific dress code. That's for employers or any public accommodations. So those old ties that restaurants could make men wear, if you'd forgotten your tie, the nasty soup-stained thing that you would have to put on, is now a thing of the past.
So you don't have to wear a jacket to restaurants? Or if they say you do, you can say, no, it's illegal?
only if it is gender neutral. So if men have to wear ties, so do women.
I see.
Same for jackets, or the same for high heels.
Now, how did this go from being really a matter of freedom and civil rights to something that now is very, very casual? And as you can hear in the voices, people enforce their own set of social norms, and it's very, very loose on the job, and I think reflects the times.
I think dress codes have always been enforced by a combination of laws and corporate rules and social norms. But what's happened is with the wedge in from Casual Friday, starting perhaps as early as the 50s, but certainly becoming popularized in the 90s, we've changed a lot what we think about appropriate dress codes for work.
In 2010, UBS, the Swiss bank, and let's just say that banks aren't exactly trendsetters in the fashion world, right?
Probably not.
We can agree with that. They had a big dress code that got leaked to the press. And here's one of the strictures in there about wearing inappropriate shoes. Women should not wear shoes that are too tight fitting, as there is nothing worse than a strained smile. That's a quote. You couldn't make that work legally in New York these days, yes?
Well, in a way, it's kind of generous. Please wear comfortable shoes. However, the way it's put is so condescending.
Yeah.
So no, you absolutely could not make that work today.
We got lots of responses from our listeners. I wear comfortable, yet beautiful clothing with flats. I gave up high heels and tailored suits over 10 years ago when I realized that my comfort level directly correlated with higher performance. I'm better able to focus on my work instead of fussy clothing that probably impresses no one in a way that I'm concerned about. In my opinion, I grew up. You want to guess what state she's or he?
Oh, goodness.
Emailing from?
Could be from almost anywhere. Perhaps California?
Yep, Texas.
Texas.
Atlanta, Georgia. I wear a work shirt and boots daily. The company just announced a more uniform attire for everyone who works in the field. You can opt out, but I think it will be mandatory eventually for everyone. People are already complaining. I don't mind. The company buys the full uniform. I'm glad to not have the extra expense of buying clothes for work. It's gotten more casual over the years if you don't interact with customers. What's the situation with uniforms?
Well, a company can still offer a uniform, but of course, it can no longer, in New York anyway, be a gender-specific uniform. You can have clothing that is more traditional for men and for women, but if the men choose the skirt, that's fine.
Are there any Brown versus Board of Education cases that really change the workplace?
Well, not so much for the workplace. There is a Supreme Court case about schools that actually said that students don't have to leave their rights of expression at the school door. And so it was about black armbands during the Vietnam War, and they said that students were permitted, in fact, to wear those black armbands in protest. However, in the school context, the primary rule is no disruption. So where Tinker against Des Moines in the 1960s might have been the high point of school freedom in terms of what students could wear, ever since that's been chiseled away because other kinds of clothing, ranging from T-shirts with political slogans to gang colors, have been considered disruptive.
And in fact, for teenagers, fashion statements are intended to be disruptive in many cases.
Absolutely. Ranging from a few years ago, girls wearing jeweled thongs above the waistband of their jeans to any number of other slightly too short, slightly too tight kind of fashion statements.
Here's someone, again, from Texas who seems to have run into reality in the workplace.
My name is Rory. I'm calling from Dallas, Texas. I wear jeans and T-shirts to work. No more wasting money on uncomfortable, dry clean-only fancy clothing.
Legal doctrine and a need for comfort are in parallel in our time, do you think?
They are certainly moving in parallel, yes.
And do you think that's a result of legal activism? Or really, it's a matter of a very few cases that have been very, very important really being taken up by workers? Because I think in many places, employers are really sensitive about liability. Here, not so much.
I think the federal standard in the U.S. is actually not that progressive. You can have gender-specific dress codes so long as they don't burden the sexes unequally. It can't be more expensive to wear the men's clothing versus the women's or vice versa. However, I think it's been a combination of concern about liability, coming down too hard on employees, and simply transparency. Other than on sitcoms, there are no private conversations in HR anymore. It all ends up on the internet, as UBS learned to its detriment. So you can embarrass yourself tremendously as an employer by appearing to be too retro in your dress code.
embarrass yourself as an employer. Oh, boy, I know that feeling. Susan Scafidi is founder and academic director of the Fashion Law Institute at Fordham University School of Law on 60th Street in Midtown Manhattan. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And here's something to take with you today. Pilgrim hats. Yes, they're quite a fashion statement, and they're about as old as a floppy disk. Remember them? They were used in the 70s and 80s, but they're still being used by the Pentagon. The Government Accountability Office reports that 3/4 of the federal government's technology budget is spent upgrading and maintaining aging computer systems. And a 1970s-era IBM computer is used to send and receive emergency action messages to U.S. nuclear forces. It uses 8-inch floppy disks to store data. The Obama administration has pushed for upgrades, but next year's budget is $7 billion less than it was in 2010. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI. Public Radio International.